Welcome to the Be Yourself Happy, Healthy, Hopeful podcast. I'm your host, Adriana Grande. I'm a health promoter at the Bulimia Anorexia Nervosa Association, also known as BANA, here in Windsor, Essex. I'm thrilled to be here with you as we begin our journey of meaningful conversations about mental health, self-acceptance, and the path to wellness. Today, I'm joined by Karen Belmore. Karen is a registered dietitian and public health nutritionist with over a decade of experience at the Windsor-Essex County Health Unit, otherwise known as WeChu. She earned her Bachelor of Science in Nutrition and Dietetics in 2012 and her Master of Science in Food and Nutrition in 2014 from Brescia University College. Karen is passionate about creating healthier communities and is especially focused on advancing more equitable and inclusive approaches to nutrition. She serves as chair-elect of the Ontario Dietitians of Public Health, where she continues to grow her impact in the field. When she's not talking or thinking about food and nutrition, Karen is a busy mom to two boys. You'll often find her at one of their sporting events, not just cheering them on in hockey, baseball, and go-karting, but also serving as a goalie coach for their hockey teams. Whenever she gets the chance, she loves spending time on the water and enjoying everything the Windsor-Essex area has to offer. Welcome, Karen. And for those listening, we hope you walk away from this episode feeling informed about the state of food security in Windsor-Essex and equipped with the tools to live a more food-neutral life. Hello.
Hello.
I'm so excited. I learned so much from you, Karen, whether it's like the toolkits you put out or seeing you out in the community. And even learning that food security was your part of your portfolio, I said, well, would you like to come on the podcast? And here we are. So thanks for coming.
Thank you so much for having me. From the bio, I am very passionate about this work, and I like to share my knowledge and hope that I can change some thoughts along the way.
Yeah. And you are obviously very knowledgeable and prepping for this conversation, doing research about food security in the area. There's like a multi-hundred page document that you have developed with your team about food security. And so who better to speak to about it?
Thank you.
Okay, so before we get into the details of your role with the health unit, can you share a bit about what drew you to working in public health and dietetics? Was there a personal moment or maybe an experience that lit this path for you?
Yeah, I started not knowing that I wanted to be a dietitian. So I do actually have an additional Bachelor of Science. I have my Bachelor of Science in Biology. Did that when I got out of high school, thought that I was going to go work in a gene lab or as a doctor. And in my final semester, I took nutrition for nursing. During that time, I was also working at the YMCA downtown on Victoria Street. And so there was a lot of things that I was seeing at the Y with the kids I was working with, and then learning in this nutrition course that it kind of clicked that dietetics was probably the best route to go with my skill set and my background in biology, and then that drive for social justice. It's a very unique position. There is only about 140 of us in all of Ontario who work in public health nutrition. So it was a, you know, I'm very lucky and fortunate that I got the role that I did once I was done, but it was really fueled by the fact that I saw firsthand what food insecurity looks like. I didn't know that that's what it was called at the time. And the impact that policy change can have on really improving lives. And so I went on up to London, did a second undergrad, and then did my master's, and was very fortunate to have my first job as the public health dietitian with the health unit.
That's amazing. I didn't know that about your kind of pivot. I think it's so interesting hearing people's journey to their current role. And I think it's good for really anyone listening who may be thinking about going into dietetics and knowing that you didn't take a linear path. I love to hear that. And
I will shout out Chris Wellington, who is a dietitian, was a dietitian within our community. She was my professor, and her passion was also a huge influence on me actually taking the journey and being like, I I love that. I love the work she's doing. So sharing what you do is also, I think, really important for those paths.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you to your prof for sparking that. Can you tell us a bit about what your specific role as a public health nutritionist is within the health unit, and what is the ultimate goal of your position?
Yes, public health nutrition is very interesting. As a dietitian, I do not see clients. I do not have one-on-one client care. I do not counsel patients. I view the entire community as my patient. So really, I'm looking at very upstream level work. We want to inform policies about food environments and supporting healthy behaviors. I work to reduce weight stigma and food to work on food neutral language within spaces that children play, grow, thrive. I work on policies and data surveillance to address household food insecurity. And I really look at the food system as a whole, how we interact with food and how food is grown in the community, accessed in the community, the availability of it, and even waste management really does change how a community can thrive. So really the ultimate goal in the position is to be able to create supportive food environments, allowing community members to nourish themselves without barriers in the best way that works for them.
Give a clap to the work that you're doing. That is a lot of work, Karen. That's a big responsibility, especially I think when I saw you a couple months ago, I told you every single community partner I talk to is like, all my clients are food insecure right now. They haven't eaten in, since the day before, maybe it's the afternoon the next day. And I don't know what it's been the last few months that everyone is just, I don't know if everyone's just talking about food insecurity a lot more in our community, but I know these like on the ground nonprofits specifically really have seen the reality that people are facing. So absolutely the work you're doing, and even thinking about data surveillance and policy, people don't appreciate those upstream factors and how important they are to address. So thank you for doing all of that work, because that is a lot.
I have a great teammate and a good overall team, but it can weigh on you, especially as the problem gets worse. We're in a service industry. I am a healthcare practitioner. I want to help, and it can feel like it's a little bit of paper pushing, but it's to get to those people who can make the actual changes. And if we're not saying it over and over again, then who will be?
Absolutely. Yeah, the advocacy piece as part of it is probably the most important thing. But for someone who may not know what food security or insecurity is, could you define it for us?
Absolutely. Food security is really a little bit more of a broader philosophy concept. So it's achieved when all individuals have reliable access to food that is safe, sufficient, culturally appropriate, nutritious. So, having absolutely no worry about the types or amounts of food that you can get. And it's really about this robust food system that a whole society needs. Inversely, when we talk about food insecurity, it's a little bit more nuanced. It's not just not having food security, because when we do data collection, we're very specific on collecting data about household food insecurity. And that is something that is measured in Canada and across the world, but it's an economic measurement. So it's really about someone's ability to afford food. So it's inadequate or insecure access to food because of financial constraints. And there's a few levels to it. So there's marginal food insecurity, and that is just the worry about food running out or having a limited selection. So the worry is enough to trigger food insecurity and some of those related health problems. Then there's moderate, which is I'm starting to compromise the quality or the quantity of food that I'm able to buy. So it would be getting less fruits and vegetables, or only buying a pint of strawberries versus maybe the three your family needs for a week, like mine does. And then there's severe food insecurity, and that is when your intake is reduced, your eating patterns are disrupted, and at the most extreme, you're going a day or days without food at all. And each one of those is measured in the household food insecurity module, which is what we get from Stats Canada, that we get those big numbers that continue to increase. So we can get somebody out of food insecurity by having that economic ability to buy food. And then to really reach that food security level is when you are able to move about freely and your whole food system in your community is like perfect.
Right. So food security is kind of like the goal of where we want to be. And yeah, I think even the talked about in the food security piece, access to culturally appropriate foods, people, they're like, oh, just go. These are just things I've heard, rather read online or heard, just like go to the food bank. Okay. But if we think about the items provided, which is like a great emergency resource, those culturally relevant foods aren't there, right?
And
So
even
it's yeah.
some major grocery stores, there definitely selection is getting better. But as a community that is rich with multiculturalism, that we do have a lot of newcomers who decide to come to Windsor, to be able to go into any store to find the food that they are familiar with and brings them comfort, it's not that easy. It's work. It's
Oh
work to
yeah.
find food that is familiar.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you for breaking that down. Even the levels, I was not aware. So I will be taking notes. When we look at Windsor Essex specifically, what are some of the unique challenges our region faces with food access right now?
So, going to that household food insecurity statistic, right now, between 2023 and 2024, our community had a rate of food insecurity of 25.7%. So,
Wow.
that's one in four local households at least have a worry about having enough money for food. It is affecting individuals who have full-time employment. This is not just a problem of somebody who is unemployed, somebody who is on assistance, social assistance. I will say that income stream tends to have more severe food insecurity because it's not adequate. But we in our community have families with full-time, 40-hour-a-week jobs that are not providing enough income, that they are worried about whether or not they can feed themselves or their family. And so there is a few layers, but really that poverty, that income is that main driver of household food insecurity. And then we do have spaces where, transportation might not be able to get an individual easily to a food outlet. We have hours of operations. If you are working many jobs just to be able to afford the food, are those places and spaces where you can get food open when you need to access them? We do have a lot of an urban-rural mix where those city concerns are very different in the county. Just taking a bus to go get something, even if it is emergency food access, is not possible. We don't have that infrastructure. And so we have that urban-rural divide. We have, access to transportation, where grocery stores are even being developed. Right now, those big box stores are starting to go on the outskirts of town, downtown, not that accessible for it. And we have people who have to work, navigate the ability to not only afford the food, but get to the food is really difficult.
I even think about like no one teaches you how to grocery shop or like how to budget for or like meal plan or anything like that. So we're just assuming everyone has all these skills and the time and the access. There's so many things that go into having food in your home aside from just the money to be able to purchase it, right?
We often talk about too, the home space? Is there the ability to cook? Is there a reliable refrigerator to store cold foods? What does your oven, stove top, cooktop situation look like? So there may be a little bit of extra money in their pockets to purchase food, but it's not enough to cover the utensils or the cooking equipment to then easily use and cook the food.
Yes, so many factors to consider. Yeah, and like I said, I feel like sometimes there's a sentiment that like, oh, if you just got another job, or if you just worked harder, or go to a food bank, then like you wouldn't have this issue. It's more of, sometimes it feels like, and this is my own personal opinion, it's always based to the individual and not the system that's in place, which I feel is just like misplaced frustration, maybe. But you did mention the income. So I do want to address this because I feel like in past conversations you and I have had, you've really highlighted how the income is actually the driving, would you call that an upstream factor, that income?
Yes. So it is a social determinant of health. How much income you have absolutely affects how healthy you are in a community. And income is the number one driver of household food insecurity. There is an entire institute of research of food insecurity called PROOF out of the University of Toronto. They have spent decades of doing research on this. And time again, it is proven when you give somebody more money who is food insecure, they will use that money to feed and nourish themselves. And the money driver, as you increase income, food insecurity decreases. There are situations where food insecurity with that worry does happen at higher incomes. And sometimes that might be lifestyle creep. But in general, it is a very linear graph. As income increases, food insecurity decreases.
Yes, absolutely. And you talked about social assistance earlier, and food is often the first thing to get cut. Like when money is tight or you're on social assistance, you have to pay your rent, you have to pay your bills, you have to pay gas to get, if you have a car to get from A to B. The food that people eat, that's like the one area of the budget that is going to get cut first.
It's really difficult because we view food as a flexible expense, but it really isn't. It really isn't. Nourishing yourself, having consistent meals, that is very important for overall health and well-being. But because no one can see hunger, it becomes the first thing to go off a budget. And honestly, in systems and institutions, it's the same way. If there's budget cuts at, I don't want to call anybody out, but like a hospital, long-term care home, any place that is giving food to their residents, food tends to be the first budget line that is cut from those large budgets. Because it's just seen as this thing that is good to have, not as that basic human right must have. And so we do that as individuals as well. Your rent, your house, your shelter becomes the priority to have a safe place to be. The food then is the thing that goes. And when we're talking about Ontario Works and Ontario Disability Program, those supplements are so inadequate that when we do our reporting, so once a year we do a report called The Cost of Eating in Windsor Essex, and we do look at income versus rent versus food. A single male on Ontario Works is negative $420 every month if they only paid for rent and food. Negative $420. That's every other item that you would need. And our food cost is literally just 61 food items. It's not paper towels, it's not soap, it's nothing, even really for baking, like sugar's not in that list. There's no coffee, like things that we may take for granted as a necessity, but really in this basket, it's not. How do you budget knowledge your way out of that type of income deficit. You can't. There is no knowledge that you could have that would get you out of that deficit.
I think when I first heard that number, like there's no way out, right? Like if you're constantly just negative month after month after rent and food, increasing that basic income is the only solution to help people navigate that, right? Yeah, sorry. I'm like thinking through what you're saying out loud right now, but yeah.
It really is. And we pay for food insecurity regardless of how we're paying for it. So, and what I mean by that is providing a basic income. I know there's a lot of tension and maybe misunderstanding about what that really looks like and means. Because it would be tax dollars going to support that type of initiative. But our tax dollars do go to things like hospital care services, to providing shelters for prisons. And when somebody's food insecure and then they become unhoused and the options are very limited for them, we pay for it anyway. Individual who's food insecure, their healthcare costs spending is 120% more than somebody who is food secure. They spend more time in hospital. They are in hospital more frequent because if you can't pay for food, how are we paying for medicines and management of chronic diseases? So think about the hospital costs that we are paying for. Wouldn't it be better to have somebody have dignity and the right to choose and nourish themselves, where we can do a basic income? And basic income, it does exist currently in a form in Canada, the Canadian Child Benefit. Anybody who has a child who registers and does their taxes gets the Canadian Child Tax Benefit. There is supplemental money month indexed for your income that helps you be able to provide for your child. We have the Old Age Income Guarantee. So there is supports for over the age of 65 in the form of government checks. We don't have anything from 18 to 64. And basic income would really be filling in that gap.
Yeah, I'm sure we could have a whole separate podcast on that basic income piece, but I did want to go back when you said the word dignity and that, basic human right to have enough food to live. I feel like that dignity piece is really often missing from the conversation. That the thing that not everyone deserves, like access, is I feel like just like a cultural problem, maybe. But yeah, I hope people listen to this and they hear that dignity piece. Maybe it'll just like change the way they see this food insecurity issue in our community, in our country, because I know this discussion is happening all over the world, in our country, in our province as well. But yeah, it just hits home when you think of it like that too. So what else as a community are we able to do to approach or get closer to that goal of food security?
It's a tough one, and really it comes down to policymakers and decision makers. As you had said, we have this concept, this view, like you said, that it is an individual problem, but it is a systemic problem. We have a system that is designed to parcel kind of groups of people out. And changing that system requires policymakers, decision makers to have the want, to have the noise from the community to do so. And so, as community members, understanding that, yes, a food drive will help somebody who's hungry today, but if we really want to support them long term, voting for individuals who want basic income guarantee, understanding what that policy would actually do for our community. That's where the big power holds. Having, if you're in a position in your work where you can advocate, I think if we had healthcare providers really their voices behind this, because it is a healthcare issue as well. Having patients who cannot nourish themselves is absolutely going to change their course of care. is you cannot afford your diabetes medication. You don't have diabetes management. And the result of that is costly for hospitals and service providers, but it's also very detrimental to the individual. So, really flipping that mindset of this isn't a person problem, this is a system problem. And what levers can we pull as community members? What are the asks that we can have to ch get those income support policies in place? That will make a huge difference. And then in the meantime, ensuring that people who are around you, they have the dignity, they don't have judgment on their food, they can have support in, if you have the ability to do food drives, but knowing that that's helping today, and we still need that bigger piece for tomorrow.
Absolutely. Okay, I feel like that was a campaign for something, but no, that was really well said. Thank you, Karen, for explaining it like that. I think our community specifically is really good for rallying for a cause, whether that be cancer care or even, eating disorder support, things like that. And so to get our community on board to push for those policy changes, I think it's possible with the right supports, right? And so really piggybacking off, like being able to piggyback off of the work that you do and your colleagues at the health unit, I think is probably like take your lead and try to push this forward is probably the most important step. Definitely something that, I even think about clients that come to BANA. A conversation we've been having is that clients will come for treatment and then leave and then not be able to access the food that they need to nourish themselves. And so it creates this barrier. They put so much effort into recovery, our clients, and then to have that struggle when they leave, it is a very tough situation to be in. And I know a lot of people in many different support spaces have similar experiences as well. And so it doesn't just affect a certain group of people either.
It's there are people that it tends to affect more, and again, it's because of how some systems have been developed. So, single moms, parents with family, parents with small children, any other marginalized community do feel the effects of food insecurity a little bit more, but there isn't a age, a gender, a race that isn't affected by food insecurity.
Right. I want to go back to when you talked about the number of for the single man. What did you talk about, like a 61 item list? Can you explain like what that process looks like and how you get to that number?
So this is called the Nutritious Food Basket Data Collection, and it is our main surveillance that we have a food affordability, and then we do some great math to look at that food insecurity and kind of how the realities are for our local community. So the Nutritious Food Basket Data Collection is in the Ontario Public Health Standards. That is something that all public health units use as a guidance for our work. So it's not just our community that does this basket collection. It's all of the health units in Ontario that are doing this. At the time of this recording, actually next week, we will be going to do our 2026 data collection. And so it is based off of the National Nutritious Food Basket. So Canada does have this national basket. It's modified a little bit for Ontario. My wonderful colleagues at the Ontario Dietitians of Public Health, they are the ones who have been able to kind of go through and navigate and set up all of the dietitians for success for this data collection. And so really these 61 items are what a person would need in order to meet their nutritional needs for a week. So it's not something that we don't release the individual items because we don't want it to be perceived as a best diet way to eat. It's not a menu planning tool. It is really food items that are in the grocery store that you can purchase relatively similarly across the province. So that whole provincial availability is important. That will give somebody from 2 plus the proper nutrition that they would need. And
Okay.
so we go out, we survey 11 different grocery stores. We have a whole protocol that we have to do. And then what we do is it goes into a nice spreadsheet. It calculates the needs for different age groups, different sexes. And with we do have some lactation and pregnancy as well, because those calorie needs are different. And we can then calculate what the average cost of food would be per week slash per month for an individual in our community.
And last year's number was over $200 a week.
Yes, it was $271.83 for a family of four. So that's parents who are between 31 and 50, a young girl, four and eight, and then a boy, 9 to 13, 9 to 14.
Yeah.
And so that works out to about $1,181 a month. So I will say, if you just took the 271 and times it by four, you won't get the 1,000. We do actually multiply it by like 4.335 to figure out the proper weeks of the year. So there's like a little bit of a math adjustment, just because not every month actually has four solid weeks. But yeah, so the data collection broke it down for needs, and price per needs per those age ranges. And then we are able to say this is what our basket is.
Wow. Yeah. Even with, families with both, parents or caregivers in the home having full-time jobs, that is a lot of money to budget for food.
Yes. And again, this is just 61 basic items. So we don't have items in there that may be regular staples for certain households that could be a little bit of money. That when we think of grocery, generally, we also think about like paper goods, like toilet paper, paper towels, soap, shampoo, hygiene products. None of that is considered. So that is just food. So we do know that that price is likely a lot higher.
Absolutely. I, in researching for the podcast, like I had no idea that this was done year over year, so you can compare the increase in cost or across the province. So I hope someone has learned this, and maybe sometimes I feel like I go to the grocery store one week and I'm like, wow, this is way more expensive than last week when I bought groceries. And so knowing that there's this measure that health units have, right, to track this and how it grows in each community, is so helpful and maybe is validating in a way to some folks that it's not just them feeling the weight of the cost of groceries all the time. I do, when we do some presentations in the community, we'll show Canada's Food Guide. And when I say, like, what are your immediate thoughts? People will say, this looks really expensive. There's so much fresh produce. This isn't a knock on Canada's Food Guide, but when I'm talking about food security, it's so much fresh fruit. There is meat in there. I know whole grains aren't necessarily or tend to be less expensive, but it can be really overwhelming to want to follow that and stay within a budget when you grocery shop. I don't know if that made sense, but
No, it is absolutely, and it is actually feedback. I've been a part of some roundtables that has been given to Health Canada, because things like canned fruits and vegetables, frozen fruits and vegetables aren't well represented, and those are tend to be more budget friendly and still very nutritious. So it's that there are alternatives that can help ease the pressure, that could be better represented in that plate, because it is very bountiful.
Yeah, so we've had to navigate some conversations, even in certain settings where people are on social assistance, they'll look at that and say, well, like I can't afford, like, what am I supposed to do if I can't afford these foods? Like, what does this mean for me? And it's really about, like, at the end of the day, the best you can feed yourself the best way that you can. It almost becomes irrelevant at a certain point, it feels like, because you just need to do what you need to do to be fed and, continue moving forward.
Absolutely. I've said before in conversations that in my job now, especially with the food insecurity portfolio, my nutrition advice is if you can eat consistently and you have access to food consistently, that's what you should be doing. And then you can add more fruits and vegetables or some fiber if you're able to, when you're able to. But being able to have food consistently without that judgment, that is still nourishing. Anything that we eat is still giving us some type of nutrient. If we are able to consume it, we are getting nutrition.
I'm going to steal that line from you, Karen. I'm going to, when I listen back to this, I'm going to write that down for the next time. You did a couple of minutes ago talk about how you categorize something differently for people who are breastfeeding. And how does food insecurity create barriers for people who are breastfeeding or accessing infant formula locally? Because a comment that we got was that someone had heard that our region has particularly low breastfeeding rates. Is there a link there? Do you know anything about that?
So we are still navigating and trying to really figure out why we do have such low exclusive breastfeeding rates, but food insecurity definitely plays into some of that. My colleague Jen, she is the one who has infant feeding in her portfolio, and I will say myself, until working with Jen a little bit more closely, our nutritious food basket data and a lot of our food insecurity data and food affordability really didn't consider those between 0 and 2 years old. But these are still little humans and they still need to eat. And especially 0 to 6 months, the only form of appropriate nutrition is either breast milk or infant formula. So to not have that cost was really a misstep. So we are actively doing some more infant formula costing and looking at these issues. The disparities for infants born to low-income families, really they're less likely to receive education and benefits of breastfeeding. There's a little bit less support to be able to continue that on. If anybody has breastfed a child who is listening, they know it is not an easy peasy free
Oh,
service
yeah.
that we like to hear about it. It does take a lot of physical and emotional support. It also takes nourishment for the mom to be able to do it. So if mom's not being properly nourished, that already sets up a little bit more difficulty to have the energy to produce breast milk. So we find that low-income families are less likely to breastfeed because there's so many barriers. And they're also the least likely to be able to afford infant formula. So it's this very unique paradox that those who could benefit from breastfeeding in terms of overall cost are less likely to do it because they are low income and there's so many barriers put into place. And so we're really trying to look at ways to support community members to get that early education, to have consistent breastfeeding supports. When we think about emergency food access, there really isn't an infant formula food access spot as well. And there's many challenges to store infant formula. Switching infant formula types is not good for baby. So you have to have a consistent brand and a consistent type. So there's definitely a multitude of challenges. And then adding that low income on top of it's really difficult to navigate.
Absolutely. I remember with my kids, we had to budget $200 a month for formula. Just going back to that social assistance breakdown, like where does that fit in? You're like then negative 600 and something dollars every month if you factor in the formula price as well, right? Also to know that there isn't that infant formula is not part of emergency supports, like at food banks and things like that. Really, where do you get support?
Yeah, we do have some great services like Building Blocks for Better Babies, who they really do work to try and work with low income families to provide some extra support. If the family mom, I believe, is on ODSP or OW, there is a special diet allowance. It's not sufficient, but it is something. And that's why our, like within the WeChew, our Healthy Babies, Healthy Children program really looks at that prenatal care as well to try and ensure that we can provide the education and link with supports as best as possible so that financial hit that may be unexpected, can be navigated a little bit differently. And also with our infant formula costing, we're doing that to ensure that families have informed choice, that they truly understand the cost of formula because it's not exactly appropriate to start and stop and start and stop. That can really affect baby's overall health. But you're making a financial commitment. And so ensuring that, again, with that data surveillance that we do, that families have all that information so that they can make the best choice for themselves.
Absolutely. And I made a note to include the link to that program in the episode description so that people have that resource and know that they're for themselves or someone they can refer to. Sometimes we just don't know what is it. There are so many supports in the community. People just don't know they're there. So we'll make sure to include that. I wanted to ask about food deserts and if this comes up at all in your work as it, I know we talked a little bit about it in terms of maybe folks in the county. Do we see food deserts being an issue, which are areas with little access to fresh food? Are there specific pockets in our community where this is a concern?
But I want to challenge the wording a little bit.
Oh,
Say
yeah,
it.
please.
Food desert gives this picture that it is a naturally occurring phenomenon.
Oh,
That
okay.
it is a desert, therefore it just happened and there's nothing we can do about it. But really, we do have neighborhoods of low access, and it's because of policies that have been created over time. In Windsor-Essex, our priority neighborhoods that have been identified through very different social service organizations, and there was actually a research study done by a University of Windsor student. Really, our high priority neighborhoods are West Windsor, downtown, and Leamington. But they're not the only neighborhoods that really experience this limitation to access. Myself live in South Windsor. I am reliant on a car to go to a full grocery service, full service grocery store, but I have the means to have the car. And therefore, it wouldn't be considered a food desert by the old terms for access. But the privilege that is required to live in a neighborhood that then you can go and access a grocery store, it has to be recognized. And so the way our communities have been built, and this is, not in the past 10 years, but over the past 50, 60 years, has really affected how individuals are able to access food. So, and as I said before too, what transportation is available? Can the individual even access that transportation from where they live to go to that grocery store? Do they have the physical ability to then take those groceries back home with them? If you are a single mother who has to take two toddlers with you, how much can you actually bring? And how many times a week could you do that? And that can happen in a lot of neighborhoods. And so really, it goes down to kind of land use planning, where food access points have been placed, transportation routes overall, and whether or not we are looking at an overall food system before we decide where new food access points go. And at the end of the day, too, you still need income to access those food access points. So how much income that neighborhood has also makes a big difference.
Okay. I just crossed out food desert in my notes. And
it's
I'm adding...
It is an important part of the conversation, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was common terminology. It's in the literature. But the more... especially from a social justice lens, when you start talking about it, it paints this picture that there's nothing we can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
But we
it's so true.
Absolutely can do something about it.
Yeah, I'm so glad you just segued perfectly into my next question with social justice, because food justice, as I've been reading, a part of social justice, is this part of the conversation at the health unit? What does it look like? How does it fit into the food security landscape? What are your thoughts?
Food justice, absolutely. It may not be named blatantly, but it is part of that health equity approach that we do take at the health unit. It's also something that as a registered dietitian, I need to be considering at all times as well. And kind of the difference and where food justice fits with like that broader food security, food system conversation is that, you know, food insecurity, as we said, was like, we've ensured that all of these measures have been met and everything's fine. Food justice looks at why those inequities existed in the first place.
Right.
So what type of structure have we created, whether it's something like our social assistance programming, can somebody get off of those programs in order to be able to secure food for themselves. But it also looks at environmental factors and really focusing on the exploitation of people and land within a food system. So ensuring that workers are getting paid appropriately for the farming and work that they do to get communities food. And then making sure that the land is being cared for and nurtured in a way that food can be continued to grow and access for generations to come. So it takes that food security part a little bit further into looking at why and then what can we do to solve those problems.
Absolutely. Incredibly important. And again, probably a whole other podcast conversation for food justice, but you really just, it sounds like you just need to just peel away these layers. It's almost like identifying or addressing the food insecurity, those three levels, right, is like the top layer. Then unpacking, you know, the workers and then the land use and where these grocery stores or food access points go. And, you know, you just keep, there's more and more and more to unpack and unravel. But it's just so important. You don't want to put a band-aid on everything all the time. It needs to be more systemic than that, which I think goes back to your original point about there needs to be systemic policy change for this to work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then go ahead.
With all like the complexities, if you've ever Googled a food system image, it is blurry and messy, and there are arrows going everywhere. It all does come back and relate. It's overwhelming. Right. And so we want to ensure that we are talking about it all, but making it great will take a lot of time, a lot of multi-sectorial effort. So sometimes in this work, it feels like nothing's happening because it is so big. So then we have to take it to those smaller points. What can we address today? How can we continue that conversation even when we're doing work over here? All of this other stuff is still very much in our minds.
Yeah, absolutely. And This is my last question about the food security policy. Then I do want to ask questions about food neutrality. But you did author the Windsor-Essex County Food Strategy Auxiliary Report. Big name. But can you just maybe explain a little bit, like high level, what does the report include? Because, like I said, it's like hundreds of pages. And what can the community learn from it or take away from it? Besides the fact that obviously a substantial amount of time and effort went into it and is a priority for the health unit, obviously, but anything else you can share would be great.
Up until recently, the Windsor-Essex County Health Unit did support the Windsor-Essex Food Policy Council. And so a lot of this work was from our Food Policy Council. Unfortunately, we've had to disband, but the work in ways still does continue. And so the food strategy, we did a large report, which was a community food assessment. You're like, where is everything in our community at? And then the food strategy tried to take those recommendations and pare them down to actionable items. So it's really a long-term framework. It's meant to be community-driven. We want to strengthen our access to healthy food. We want to support the local economy. We're aligning with municipal action. And it's really that big, big food system work. But this strategy really, anybody in their day-to-day life, in their work, if they are able to make policy change, a municipality can take this report and go through it and find an actionable item that they can do to strengthen our food system. One big thing that we had talked about was something like our organic waste program, and it is up and running.
I
And
love it.
fantastic. I love it because it is a way to ensure a healthy food system. Food system is everything from growing it to throwing it away. And so that organic waste does matter. And putting the food products in the organic waste and using your grain bin is actually supporting our local food system and our overall community well-being. So it seems really far removed when it comes to food, especially talking about, with the lens of food insecurity, but it is a part of that broader food system. So really this report pulled out actions. It's not the only actions that we could take, because there is so many. As we said, it's a very large web of things, but it's small steps that we can all take, pulling the levers that we have control over in order to work towards that just food system.
Yeah, I love everything that comes out of the health unit that's relevant to my role anyway. The toolkits that are released or these reports, they're always like action focused. Like, what are we doing? And I do appreciate what you said about what levers can we pull? Because, yeah, there are some things like we can't change that basic income, but what are the other things that we can do now to move things forward while we wait and advocate and champion for those other bigger structural changes to happen. And so I just want to say thank you for you to you and your team for putting in all that work, because any small step forward we can take will make a huge impact for the people in our community. So yes, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for acknowledging it. It was a report that happened slightly. The big one was pre-pandemic, and the smaller strategy was a little post. So some of that work has not, I think, gotten some of the love and attention that it should have. So thank you for highlight finding it and highlighting it.
I love a good shout out. And I remember when I was prepping and I opened it. Well, I hadn't opened it yet. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna download this. I'm gonna read it over the weekend. And then I opened it and I was like, this might date me a little while. So no, very robust, very much appreciated. Okay, I do want to shift gears a little bit because your portfolio at the health unit also involves food neutrality, which is something that really aligns with my role as a health educator, with BANA, our values and how our clinical team supports clients. So Can you explain what food neutrality is?
Food neutrality is an approach to change the way we think and talk about food and our eating habits. So this approach is to remove moral judgment that we often assign to foods. So really taking away the language and kind of the mindset that there are things, foods that are healthy versus unhealthy, good versus bad, junk, those negative labels. Food is not, it has no moral value. Eating a certain way doesn't change the type of person you are. Nourishment needs to be nourishment. And we've really gone down a path of the way we think we ought to nourish ourselves. And it's caused a lot of harm. So really this food neutral approach is trying to reclaim the fact that food is food. It does all fit, and we don't have to label it in these negative ways. And I will add in that this doesn't remove the fact that foods have different nutritional value. It's just the fact that foods don't have any moral value.
Absolutely. That's really hard for people, myself included. I know even I've been with Bina for 3 years now, and how much unpacking I've had to do around how we label food, how we talk about it. And then I think especially like being out in the community with kids and even adults and watching them try and unpack it, it's not an easy thing to do.
Not at all.
Yeah, so how have you seen it change, I guess, over the years? Because I feel like at one point it was encouraged to say, this is good, this is bad. That snack you're having is healthy, that's junk. Like, how has this changed? How have we gotten to food neutrality as an approach?
It has vastly changed. And when I was in my internship to becoming a dietitian, a main strategy was to teach kids things like whoa, slow and go foods or red light foods and green foods, and really putting foods in these buckets and this hierarchy of one's better than the other from this perceived lens of health. And now, and really, it did take, through my experience, especially with the Ontario Dietitians in Public Health, it took a lot of realization of where this food judgment came from. A lot of it is rooted in racism and colonialism. That's hard for people to hear, and I do appreciate and understand that it can feel awkward and uneasy because it's the way that we were all taught. It is the way we've talked and learned about nutrition and food in the past had this very Western lens to it. But we've had to do that unpacking. We've had to understand even where some of our main documents have come from. Canada's Food Guide was first designed based off of food experiments that were done on children in residential schools. It's been a lot for a profession to say we're using these tools that are highly inappropriate. How do we reconcile with all of that? And where did it lead us to with our dietetic education? And so I say a big kudos to a lot of the dietitians working in public health who we created spaces to have these conversations. And we kind of sought out around. We knew we weren't the only ones thinking this way. There's been amazing work done in British Columbia and Alberta. Ellen Satter is a fantastic leader in this relationship with food and how do we repair and raise confident eaters. And it all came back to the way about how grown-ups talk about food, especially in the presence of children. And so we're seeing that shift now in actually some dietetic education is changing. So actually new dietitians coming into spaces have a better knowledge, are recognizing that some of our old ways of talking about food we're pretty rooted in racism. In my internship, I was told to tell some individuals not to have white rice, have brown rice instead because it's healthier for you. When you look at the nutritional components, it's 1 gram of fiber more. When you look at the cultural importance of white rice, it is massive. So not appropriate for me to be making that recommendation based off of a small nutritional increase because we were completely missing the plot about the cultural relevance. So we really now talk about instead of this is how you get to a perfect diet, and here's the things you should be restricting to fit this picture of ideal. We really talk about that, do you have that consistent access? Where can you add nourishment? And how are you relating to food that helps bring you joy, honor your culture, and ensuring that you are doing what you need for your body, because we're all very different.
Yeah, I find that with like, how do you know what I need? Just, which again could be a whole other conversation, but thank you. I didn't know that about Canada's Food Guide and the unlearning, and I'm sure relearning new ways and all the work that was done, something I can take with me today and share with others to make sure that, things have changed for a reason, and this food neutral approach is also so multifaceted in how we approach things. Marissa and I are in schools a lot, and we get questions from teachers about how to make sure kids eat healthy, or they should eat their healthy food before their junk food, and a lot of concern about setting kids up to not live a healthy life, which, like, sometimes these kids are 4 and 5 years old, right? So it's not really their decision. You talked about Ellen Satter, like, that's not a child's responsibility to do that. So I do share your supportive food environment in schools toolkit a lot, which I will also link in the episode description so people have access to it. Can you tell us a bit more about what this resource is, the toolkit, and what a teacher's role is when it comes to the food a student brings to a class?
Thank you. Yeah, the support, it's a lot. So the Supportive Food Environment Toolkit is really designed to support all adults within a school, and really parents could view it as well. It is on our website. A lot of the principles very much can be taken in the home as well. But it's really designed to help create an environment that is free of judgment, kind of foster curiosity around food and build a positive relationship with food for those students. You said that, the concern is if we let children have these foods, they're going to be unhealthy adults. And that restriction actually does the opposite effect. It makes those foods seem so desirable because they're forbidden. And so actually restricting and making judgments is not leading us to the place that we think it's going to do. And I do appreciate parents and teachers, coming at it from a place of concern. But we do have the research to back now that that approach is not working. So this toolkit is really to help set up that physical environment and that social environment so that children can get to that skill set of having a positive relationship with food and learning how to nourish their bodies. Ellen Sattler's division of responsibility really talks about the roles we each have when it comes to food, especially when we're feeding children. And so, in a school setting, it is the role of the school to determine when and where the students eat. They also could determine if food is offered or sold on premise. And there are some guidelines that they actually have to follow for that. The role of the parent or caregiver is to provide food for that day. And it's the role of the student on their own to decide, if they want to eat, how much they want to eat, and what order they eat it in. And this is really to build trust within the adults in their lives, as well as trust within themselves. And we know that babies are fantastic intuitive eaters. They will stop. They will refuse to put that bottle or breast in their mouth. They will fight you when they are full. And we allow that to happen. As soon as food and independent eating comes into play, it's our natural instinct as parents to try and override what the child feels. But that actually creates a system where they don't trust themselves because the adults around them don't trust them. And so this division of responsibility is really to help a child get back to that intuition to say, I am hungry. I need to eat. I am full. I need to stop. I understand that these foods make my body feel a certain way, and I know that these foods make my body feel maybe a different way. We can still have guidelines and parameters around it, but removing the judgment is very important. Removing that, well, you're hungry, or you can't possibly still be hungry. Can't possibly be full. We want to ensure that we're trusting the students or our children. And we want to ensure that a child can trust that their parent or caregiver at home is providing them with safe options during the day. And when teachers or other adults come in and pass judgment about a lunchbox, it sends a signal to that child that either my parent gave me something that's not safe, or my parent gave me something that's bad. Why would my mom or dad give me something that's bad? If they consume that food, they take on that impression. I must be bad because I'm eating this bad food. And then there's an adult with conflicting information. And they really lose their sense of safety and their intuition if we don't have kind of that neutral approach with them.
Like, what a gift we can give a child to say, like, I trust you to listen to your body. I feel like that's so much of what adults have to like unlearn in, as they get older. But what it, as hard as it is for an adult to follow this, division of responsibility, what a gift it would be to let kids determine, like, figure that out for themselves. The way I describe it to when I, whether it's like a parent at a booth or a teacher in a school, like this is a long game. I know it's hard. There's so many pressures, on social media from other, from our own parents or a different generation or friends. So much pressure to want our kids to eat a certain way. And so it could be like countercultural in a way to approach it with food neutrality in that division of responsibility. But I think having a toolkit and kind of like a map, a breakdown of how we can approach it is really helpful. So I think that will be, it will help making that transition from an old way of doing things to a new way a lot easier for people. And like you said, it does really could be applied in the home as well. A lot of those things could be applied in the home, which is really helpful. And I do want to also end the comment about the schools. I have so much respect for teachers and the responsibility that they have. And, 99% of the teachers I have met through my job just like care about their students so much. And so I also want to say that, like, just because you've done something before, it might be hard now, but I know at the end of the day, they just care about their students' well-being, and it's just going to look different. I want to talk. I just have a couple more questions. I mean, I have a lot, but I'll save it for a couple. I want to talk about, or if you have like thoughts or considerations about, it's hard to be neutral about food when you don't have enough of it. So how do you address that intersection where someone is struggling both with a limited budget and a disordered relationship with food? What approach could we take there?
This is something that is extremely difficult. I I did a presentation for University of Windsor before where it talked about diet culture and food insecurity and how do you know how to nourish yourself? How do you, because there's a lot of shame and guilt and other emotions that come along with these struggles. And so really, it is one reason why this food neutral approach overall is so important, is that the people around us, we don't know what they're dealing with. We don't know everyone's full picture. And so when the people around you are able to view food in a neutral way, it does help a little bit in that overall, eating the food you have access to. I think perfect nourishment and nutrition is not the goal for everybody. And we shouldn't assume that it is the goal for everybody, especially if we think of people in recovery or if you have a disordered relationship with food and haven't been able to find support, if you have sensory issues, if you have medications that may be suppressing appetite for a variety of different reasons. We need to respect everybody and not ex have this judgment that 100% of vitamin minerals, a perfect macro is going to be achieved by every person. And when we stop judging others about it, it's a little bit easier to stop judging ourselves. And so being able to have mantras or respect to say, I am nourishing my body with the food I have access to. I am doing a good job. Hope to help with that intersection between the limited budget and that, disordered relationship with food. You are not a bad person because you had access to ramen noodles. It is fantastic you had the ability to consume ramen noodles that day and give your body some energy that it needs. That's the other philosophy too, where you can add nutrition when you can. When you have access to fresh or frozen canned fruits or vegetables, add that nourishment in to your ramen noodles, and now you're doing even better. You're getting that nourishment and knowing that you had access to more this time around. But if you have excess to less next time, that's okay too. Because that nourishment has to be the main goal of consistent, not perfect nutrition, but consumption of food.
Consistent nourishment. I like that. That term is the goal for majority of people, it feels like. That's really helpful. Thank you. Okay, last big question, and I have a couple little ones, but looking ahead 5 to 10 years, what does a food secure and food neutral Windsor Essex look like to you? Or the work that you do, or like, what is the goal as your team?
I think in 5 to 10 years, the food neutral one, majority of us are talking the same language, and we are on to the next level of it. If I can build programs that are more about joy and the fun of cooking rather than ensuring that kids feel safe in spaces, I think that would be a great success story because we've been able to achieve that basic need of safety and now bring that fun and exploration in. With food security, it's having strong policies in place that really do support the individuals that are most at need and having community members that aren't against providing that type of support. Because I think that's the twofold. We have to have a community that respects the fact that we need these dignified responses, and then having those community members be able to benefit from those type of policy responses.
I think those are both achievable. I think we can get there.
I hope.
Okay, so I always ask if guests have a specific story or instance. So for you, has there been a story or instance where working on food neutrality or food security policy has helped someone in particular that's like really stood out for you?
So I guess not unfortunately, but there hasn't been that big this solved it for me type of moment. But I definitely can sit back and recognize the slow burn in the shifting of the thought process. When I first started talking about really going strong into some of these food neutral approaches, it was not well received. There's this perception that nutrition then doesn't matter and everything's out the window and everyone's just going to eat ice cream all day long and not know what to do. But if we go back to that intuitive eating, you know when your body needs different types of nourishment. So I'm not worried, but that was the perception. To now, we're in spaces where I bring up food neutral approaches, I bring up how we talk about food or teach about food, and there's examples of that positive shift. There's a click or an aha moment you can see flash in someone's eyes that, oh, I get why this would be important. And now I have some tools to make it happen. So I think those moments always make me feel like I'm on the right path, that we are getting there. When food insecurity is coming up in conversations that aren't necessarily driven by me, in spaces that it hadn't been in before, that feels successful, that I've been a squeaky wheel enough that spaces are recognizing it, using the right terminology, and looking for solutions. So in population health, public health, nothing happens quickly. We are changing health behaviors, and that takes a long time. So the fact that I can see some of these behaviors actually shifting, is that success for me.
Yeah, I think working in policy and public health, you have to be okay with that slow burn. You have to be okay with those little wins along the way, right? Yeah, you're right. I definitely see a difference even a few years about food neutrality in the community. And so it is exciting to see more people talk about it and acknowledge the benefits of it, which is really nice. All right. And if our listeners could only take away three simple facts about food security in Windsor, Essex, what would they be?
One would be that food does need to be viewed and absolutely is a human right. It's not something that is a reward or should be earned or is only for certain people. We all need food. We all need consistent food to thrive. And so how are we going to help people meet that basic need? That's number one. Number two is household food insecurity is an income issue, and we cannot charity our way out of it or pull up our bootstraps and work harder to get out of it. Income policy needs to be in that conversation. And then it's that dignity piece again. Our com food insecurity does come with costs. Why not choose the cost that will provide dignity for our community members? Think about how lovely it would be that everyone in our community felt safe and supported and being able to achieve what they need to achieve for themselves.
Excellent 3 points. You did not shy away from that question, and I love it. Thank you. Where can listeners find more information about the work that you do, Karen?
So, quite a bit of my work does happen, I think, like behind the scenes in a way. But we do have our website, which is wechew.org. And if you do slash food, there is resources that you could check out. I did a 15 video YouTube series called You Can Cook that does provide some really basic kitchen skills. So you could check out the video series and then learn more about food insecurity and some of that food system work. On our website as well, we have resources for teachers in our school section. So that supportive food environment toolkit can be found there, and quite a bit of information about body image and even how to pack a lunch at school, because I know that can be tricky sometimes. And then we have a whole section for expecting and new parents that can help with some feeding resources as well as some just general health resources.
Excellent. Thank you. And like I said, we will include all those links to those specific questions, because I know the health unit has so much information on their website, which is great. Amazing. Thank you, Karen, for taking the time today to join me. I know so many folks who are listening will find this conversation helpful, eye-opening, and will hopefully have a bit more compassion either for themselves or people in our community when it comes to the decisions they're having to make around food. And for anyone listening, if you are interested in learning more about eating disorders specifically in Windsor, Essex, please find us on our socials at Banna Windsor, our website, banna.ca, or read more in the Banna Be Yourself magazine. Thank you for joining us today, and we will see you next time.